Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast for people who stab ground cloth.
That's a good one.
I think that's the best one yet. I think so.
I like it.
Yeah. Okay, our guest this week, Gene Farish. Hi, Gene.
Hi, how are you?
I think we're going to be okay. Yeah. Gene of Gene Farish Needleworks and Stitchers Escapes, which is a whole program for stitching cruises. Yeah.
Which sounds delightful.
Yeah.
They are, I tell you, they're a blast. Every time we've launched one, we've been excited. And as soon as we've gotten back home, we're like, okay, let's do this again.
How did you get, we got no order here tonight. So how did you get started doing stitching cruises? Where does that come from?
It's absolutely crazy, and I have to credit social media. I started a Facebook group with a friend called Stitchers Escapes, with the idea of it being like a community bulletin board, so that anyone who was organizing any kind of a camp or class or retreat could post the information there. And one night, somebody posted and said, oh man, I really wish I could go on a cruise and stitch. And somebody else chimed in, and somebody else chimed in, and it grew out of that.
You created a monster.
Well, you know, Gary, I think that the thing is, it fits. I don't want to pigeonhole this, because I mean, everybody is welcome. But there are women of a certain age who love to travel, do not necessarily have a travel buddy to go places with. And so a cruise is perfect for them, because you're going with 100 of your best friends that you didn't meet until you got on the ship necessarily. and you know that when you are in this environment, that you're with people who quote unquote get you, that yes, don't think that what you're doing is strange. And so I think it kind of speaks to both of those things. And I think that's why they've been successful from the very beginning.
So out of this Facebook page, then, so how many cruises a year do you do? I mean, from your website, there's at least two or three going.
Right. 2016 was the first one. We sailed out of Seattle and went up to Victoria, British Columbia, went south down to San Francisco. And that was great. I have to tell you, and a lot of people don't know this, but I had never been on a cruise ship in my life. And I'm standing there on the dock in Seattle, and I'm thinking, lady, you are absolutely crazy. You've never been on a cruise ship. On that particular cruise, the first one, we had 77 people. And I thought, I am responsible for 77 people to have a great time, and I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing. But we did. We had a fabulous time, and then 2017, last year, we sailed out of Boston, and missed all those storms last fall, and went up to a couple of destinations in Canada, and that was absolutely great. We had 102 on that cruise. This coming September, we're sailing out of Southampton in the UK, and going to Bruges, Hamburg, and Oslo. So I'm really excited about the stitching that we're going to see on that particular cruise. And then in 2019, for the first time, we're doing two. In May, we're going to Bermuda. And then in September, we're going to sail up into Alaska.
Oh. Oh.
That sounds phenomenal.
Oh, so, the Alaska. Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, see, this is, well, see, this is dangerous, because my wife would go on a cruise, I think, in a minute, and cruises are just not, they just don't appeal to me, because too many people crammed into a small space is the way it looks like to me. I'm sure that's not the case, but to go to Alaska is one of those things on my list.
Well, and I'll tell you, the Alaska cruise, as well as the Bermuda one, were on what they consider a quantum class of ships. It's absolutely huge. I never got a sense of feeling crowded at all. other people, you know, may chime in with a different feeling about that. But these ships, I mean, it's like a huge floating hotel. And how much you are interacting with other people is, you know, totally up to you. One of the things that we do by working directly with Royal Caribbean is we end up with a fabulous conference center that's at our disposal. So we're not trying to set up classes. And I'm not disparaging what anybody else has done, but very often on cruises, the classes are in the corner of a dining room, or they're in a lounge or a bar area when it's not being used by the public. And I just take my teaching a little bit more seriously than that. So for a fledgling business, I have to give them credit. They, from the very beginning, they believed in this concept and they said, yeah, we can do that with you. Because I said from the very beginning, I'm not going to do this if you cannot promise me a dedicated space for our stitching. And, you know, they were on board with it. So that's been great.
Yeah. Now what's running through my head as you talk about this is your first statements about, you know, frankly, older people who have lost spouses or are alone once again, to be able to go. I'd never thought about it that way, to be able to just spend a week or 2 weeks with people who do what you like. That's kind of neat. That's a neat thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do have to tell you though, Gary, that I think, and again, I'm no expert in that whole industry, but I am fairly confident in saying that the profile of the typical cruiser has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. It's people of all ages. Both of my daughters are coming on the cruise in Europe, as well as their husbands and my only granddaughter. So among us, we've got, you know, a 10-year-old, a couple 40-somethings, and me, who has seen more than her share of decades.
Okay, so you're 49. You're 49. Okay, fine.
Yeah, my daughter recently made a post about, she was all shocked because she now has to wear readers, use readers. And I'm like, how old do you think that me feel to think
like that's a big deal?
Right. Well, like they say, you know, aging is not for sissies. But I tell you, I think that the stitching is what's keeps me young. I mean, I'm constantly learning things, and I love to teach. I love to explore things. And I just don't see retiring. You know, they're going to have to shove me aside
Well, but isn't that one of the benefits of hobbies like this? I mean, that's even if you're working, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, for most people, it's somewhat cyclical. I mean, I often see this on, and I keep bringing up Facebook. I mean, that's, you know, let's face it, that's how a lot of us communicate with each other. You know, where people say, well, I used to do cross stitch a lot, and now that my kids are small, I'm not doing as much. And it's like, you know, that time will come. You know, you're doing something different with your life right now. And so I think that's part of it. But, you know, it's definitely a lifetime pastime. I mean, there's, you know, other than severe ill health getting in your way, there's really nothing to keep you from doing this well, you know, at any age.
Right. Well, I was having a conversation with someone, a listener today, just a brief exchange, 22 years old. And she said that she listens to us while doing housework. And I said, well, I'm glad we can help you get through that. But the point of her thing was that there are, because she was responding to some statement we'd made about encouraging young people to get involved in this hobby. And she was just pointing out there are young people, and she does it as much as she can. And I was just mentally thinking about, as you like you said, cyclical. I mean, I started in college and did it fairly aggressively, then you get married, have kids, and you know that kind of time, and not to mention the money, doesn't always right. exist. And then as you get older, the time certainly starts to show up more, and you do often, at least I hope people have a few more resources to spend for Thread, and yeah, and then it comes back. But the fact that you have it all through that is you have something you can turn to. And how many people have we heard from who stitching has gotten them through traumatic periods in their lives, sitting in hospital rooms or other things, and just being able to distract themselves a little bit with stitching. I mean, it really has value at various stages of the lives. And you don't have to look very far to find people who benefited at all ages from just having a needle and thread and something to do with their hands and a little bit to do with their minds. A lot right. to be said for it, yeah.
And there's also many cases where needlework has helped people through physical therapy.
Yes.
That they have needed to exercise those fine motor skills. And because they had such a desire to do their needlework, they persevered. And, I mean, I once knew a woman who was flat on her back, and she insisted with her family and friends that they set it up so that she could still do her needlework while she was in recovery. And her doctor credited her needlework to a large extent for how quickly she recovered.
Yeah. There we have it right there. So take us back to the cruise ship now. So you're able to get a conference room of some size and yes. have it all to your own. So that tells me I can bring my stuff and I can set it up and I can leave it for the duration of the cruise. And
it's not, it all depends on the ship's configuration,
okay.
but, in my very brief experience so far, there are times when the conference center, depending on what deck it's located on, might be a point of egress. And
oh, okay.
For that reason, they don't ever guarantee that it's going to be 100% secure. So it's not quite the same as having a ballroom in a hotel for that reason. But you certainly would be, you know, knock on wood, so far we have not had anybody bother things that people have left their things and gone and had lunch and come back or whatever. But I have very conservatively suggested that people not leave things in the conference center overnight.
Oh, okay. But certainly during the day, you can kind of camp out there.
Yes. I'll tell you, here are two other things about the cruise I find interesting. Is one is that there are not a lot of needlework retreats that non-stitching spouses or friends or mothers or daughters or daughter-in-laws would love to come with you.
That's
true. But on a cruise, you know, it's already set up for activities for people of all ages and all interests and whatnot. So even a person who is not interested in the stitching in what we're doing as a group has plenty of entertainment opportunities. And so I think that's been part of the appeal that, and especially like I'm finding with the Bermuda cruise, well, actually all three cruises that we're taking registrations right now, the Europe one, we probably have a dozen couples coming. Bermuda and Alaska are kind of following that pattern where people are saying, hey, you know, cruises are for everybody. And so I can go do my thing and my husband or mother or daughter or granddaughter or whomever can, you know, have plenty of things to do. So that's one thing I think that makes it a little bit different than a land-based retreat. The other interesting thing is how we do behave ourselves well. I'm not going to say that people are because we're not behaving well. But we, you know, it doesn't take long before people are like, oh, wait, you're part of that stitching group. You know, we kind of get a rep, and it's interesting. We're like a magnet for other people who, either they themselves will say, oh, I also do that type of needlework. Or, you know, the classic thing is my grandmother used to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a great conversation starter. And so, you know, we might start out with 100 people in our group, but effectively there are times that we feel more like 200.
Okay. You're starting to sell me on this thing. This is interesting. All right. All right. And you have classes too?
Well, Gary, think of all the podcasts you can do.
Oh, go. like I haven't all thought about that already.
All the people you can interview. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Christine and I never get any stitching done. We just talk to people and record it. Yeah. All right.
No, wait a minute. Wait. Did anybody say we actually get stitching done?
Well, that was an assumption. Wait a minute.
Yeah. But you know what? I mean, how many, I mean, this happens all the time. You'll talk to people and they'll say, I went to the stitching retreat and I hardly got anything done, but they had a blast and they come back again. Because, you know, one of the things that happens is you start chatting with other people and, you know, it just becomes it's a bit of a party atmosphere.
Yeah. Well, that happens to me with our local needlework guild meetings. I used to take stuff and set up my little thing and ready to stitch through the meeting, like, you know, because a lot of ladies do. And after a while, I just realized I'm just wasting my time hauling stuff. I just don't even take anything to the meetings anymore, because, you know, you talk to people and you're listening to the presenter. And yeah, I know that feeling. Like, why'd I bother?
Right. Yeah. And then there's the other end. I design a sampler to go with each one of the cruises. And last year I had two women. One who absolutely finished the whole sampler by the time we got back to Boston, and one I think was almost done. So it does happen that people get very, very, very intense about their stitching. So,
wow. I would never be in that group, ever.
I was absolutely amazed. And I didn't stitch the original in a week, that's for sure.
I'd never be in that group. Jeez. There's some people, though, those needles fly. I'll tell you, it's amazing. I don't know how they do it. I don't know how. So, all right, we kind of started in the middle. Let's go back. How do you get involved in needlework? What's your story? And part of that story is Spirit of Cross Stitch TV program.
Right, which actually started with the Spirit of Cross Stitch Festival. And that was in the 90s. And I have to say it's one of the most amazing things that I ever did. Spirit of Cross Stitch Festival started out as a concept that was born from going to trade shows and knowing that the average consumer was seeing maybe 1/10 of what we were seeing as professionals. And a bit of a story here. I'm in the middle of five girls, and one of my sisters lived in a rural area outside Charlottesville, Virginia. And I was stitching with her one day on Black Aida. And she was like, oh my gosh, Black Aida. When did they start making Black Aida? And I realized in talking to her that she had to drive 30 minutes each way to buy a skein of floss. She did not know there was anything except for white and ivory ecru Aida. And that kind of just gelled with me and said, you know, just think about if the average consumer could come and see what we could see at a trade show. And so Spirit of Cross Stitch Festival was a consumer show. The first one was here in Winston-Salem, and 3,400 people came.
Mm. Wow.
Wow.
The next year we had four, Sacramento, California, Des Moines, Iowa, Winston-Salem, and Saratoga Springs, New York.
You went from from one show to four in a year?
Yes.
Wow. Holy smokes.
our biggest show. And so from there, the smaller shows would have like 5,000 or 6,000 people who would come to them. But after, it didn't take long for us to outgrow Saratoga Springs, New York, and we moved the show to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, where we had 10,000 people.
That's crazy.
Come. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is,
goes
this
to
is
show
how
you
I got.
People are starved for information, though.
We offered classes. Classes started on Thursday, and we had classes Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and up until Sunday afternoon. We usually had about 10 classrooms going, about 30 teachers. And I think that that is the most exciting thing that I've ever done, because it introduced, it was a springboard for a lot of new designers and teachers who were excellent designers, excellent teachers, but didn't have an audience. And it gave them, I guess it's sort of like an open mic for comedians, you know, where it gave them a place that they could come and teach. And I would say on average, our students were certainly impressed with the stars that came, the big name designers, but they also loved learning from people who brought them things that were new to them. Black work, pulled and drawn thread work, reticella lace, a head of bow. And it was exciting. It was absolutely exciting. We did that for 10 years, and it was fun.
Wow, that's a good run. Ooh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then a TV show comes out of this?
Yeah, so kind of in the middle of all this, we went to public television and pitched the idea of the show, and they liked it. And so we did 13 half-hour episodes, sort of a magazine format. I would interview a designer, did kind of a little marketplace segment talking about, for example, pearl cotton and the different sizes. And we would try to do something kind of on the road, like go to a historic site that had some needlework connection. And again, I had no idea what I was doing. I was a seventh grade geography teacher before I became a needlework designer. And that was, you know, that was the experience and the education I brought to this. I didn't have any broadcast experience or whatever. I just had this dream and just kind of followed it.
Now, of course, this was in the 90s, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that, I mean, that at that time, cross stitch was just raging hot too.
Yes. You know, it's interesting how it's been raging hot and then cooled off, and but I always come back to the fact that cross stitch is timeless. I was absolutely amazed when I saw a piece of cross stitch that was 5,000 years old in a museum, and I would say to myself, this is not ever going to go away. I mean, it's easy, it's inexpensive, I mean, just look at all the antique samplers that are done by 7 and 8 and 9 year olds. So it's not something that you have to do for 20 years before you're any good at it.
Yeah.
And yet you can still do it when you're 90. So.
And I think we're seeing these days a real resurgence, particularly of cross stitch, but I think of stitching in general. But cross stitch, you know, as a result of the internet and floss tube and this whole sampler world, geez, it's just amazing how many people are working with reproduction samplers. But there just seems to be a real resurgence of interest at all levels. I don't know if you're seeing that, but it just seems to me like there's really a lot of activity that's not slacking off.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I really like, and I mean, it's not my, I don't lean in this direction as a designer, but you know, all the avant-garde stuff that's being designed, so that there really is something that appeals to everyone. I mean, you know, you go back to the 70s and 80s, and, you know, I look at my own designs, and, you know, it's a lot of Americana, a lot of what we called country in the 80s, now primitives. But there's also, on the other extreme, you know, some pretty wild stuff that's being designed and stitched. So I have to say that one of the positive things that I see now compared to the 1980s when I started is that there really is something for everyone. If you have a particular design style in mind, you can find some needlework that goes with it.
Yeah, there really is. And when you look at, I mean, I guess Facebook is really at the crux of the communication that goes on. Some blogs still, people keep those going, but that's a lot of work to do that. But the number of groups that there are on Facebook, closed groups, and I think that's a real plus and a real value, is closed groups, so that people can have their own little communities. And then, of course, what all those thousands of people are doing with FlossTube and putting up those videos, I mean, they've created their own little community of people who just feed off of each other and enjoy what each other's doing, no matter where you're at in the world. And it's fun to watch.
Right. Well, I mean, it's an interesting mix, because you can enjoy your needlework and do exquisite work completely by yourself, and yet it can also be a very social thing. And I don't know a lot of pastimes that are like that. If you love to play bridge, you can't do it by yourself. Needlework, you can. And yet you can also sit in a room with people for real and stitch. And chat and stitch and chat and eat and stitch and chat. Or you can sit at home, and as you're stitching, you know, I sit there with my laptop. I mean, it must seem like some days I'm on Facebook all day long, but I'll sit there and I'm stitching and I've got Facebook open, and every once in a while I'll glance over and think, oh, look what this person had to say. Well, you know, and so you're connected to people all over the world. I mean, needlework really is a universal language. And I think the first published needlework book I ever got was a gift, and it was in Greek. I had a relative that was traveling, saw this book when he was in Greece, knew it looked like something that I had done, and bought it and gave it to me. And I'm like, huh, I can still follow these directions, because I understand it.
Right.
I don't have to know the words.
Yep. Yep. It's kind of like music. Yep. I can figure it out. Don't. Yep. Mm-hmm. It has its own visual language. Yes. So absolutely. How do you get to the designing part? Because you have a lot of designs. How do you convert from stitching to designing?
Well, I think that the designing kind of came first, really. I really have not stitched a lot of things that other people designed. I just, without making this sound like an episode of Oprah Winfrey here, my needlework career was really born out of a divorce. I was a seventh grade geography teacher, and two small children, and one of my sisters had a friend who was opening a needlepoint store in Ocean City, New Jersey. And Scrim Discovery is still there. And Donna, the owner, through my sister, said, hey, would you be interested in painting some custom needlepoint canvases for me? And I'm like, oh, sure, I can do that. Having never done it before.
You're like Mikey. You're like Mikey. You'll do anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I'm artistic. So I was desperate. So I started painting needlepoint canvases. And I tell you, I really liked it. I mean, I did a lot of custom stuff. Turtle crossing sign. boats, dogs, houses, you know, all the same stuff that people are painting now. This was in the late 70s. And after a while, I started also painting kind of some of my own ideas. And I got tired of painting them. I mean, I was painting the same, you know, angel over and over and over again. And about that time, I discovered counter cross stitch. And so I thought, wait a minute, you mean I can like do this like one time? And then I just go and make, you know, 100 copies of it. And so that's kind of what got me, you know, where I kind of jumped ship from needlepoint to cross stitch. And, you know, I have to say, I love both. I'm getting more back into needlepoint than I ever thought that I would. Teaching it, designing it, getting back into painting custom canvases. And I find that the two forms of needlework, although they seem like first cousins, they're very distant first cousins. They each have their own characteristics and passions and pluses and minuses, I guess you'd say. But it's really interesting, kind of with a foot in both worlds. So that's kind of how I got started. It was really by designing needlepoint. And it wasn't long before I realized that I better learn how to stitch it if I was really going to be a very good
You think? You think that might be a good move?
You think. So then got into the teaching part of it, you know, because the teaching came very naturally, since that's what I was professionally before I got into the needlework. But
if that teaching's in your blood, it's real easy to, you know, the topic almost doesn't matter, I think, with obvious exceptions, but something like that, because it's really the. I'm a former teacher too, and it's, to me, it's the thrill of putting together a presentation, a lesson, and then delivering it, and then watching the little light bulbs go on. To me, that's the subject matter almost is secondary to me.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like if I know how to do it, I'm going to figure out how I can teach it to somebody else.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It just like you say, it's in your blood, so.
Yeah,
and it's fun.
If you're not sure how to do it, teach it. You'll get sure in a hurry.
That's so true.
That's right. And that's where I tell you, I love my A&G chapter, because already they have, we've already done one project where I said, you know, I need to do a pilot class. And again, to come back to the cruise topic, was when it hit me and I said, wait a second, once I'm on this ship, if I don't have it, I'm not going to have it. It's not, you know, running out to Michael's and getting, you know, more skeins of something. So I very quickly recruited them to be a pilot class. And I tell you, we've got a great A&G group here in Winston-Salem, and they're a real inspiration and become very, very good friends.
Yeah, those pilot classes. I've got to do one. We in our needlework guild, the Fox Guild, it's not unusual once or twice a year to have someone piloting a class, and I've just never done it. They mainly because they fall on weekends when I'm just not available. But what a great way for both people in the class and instructor to learn. I got to believe that's a real back and forth exchange going on there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So all kinds of designs for you. What are your favorite things to design? What inspires you?
You know, that's, I guess, I'm a traditionalist, and I like Americana, and two of my most popular, well, definitely my most popular design and one of my most favorite designs actually came out of games I played with my kids in the car driving across country. And of course, no, you can, we oldies are already saying, you know, lamenting the fact that, you know, so much has changed that, you know, nowadays parents get in the car and the kids are watching the DVD or playing electronics. And but you know the old game of you name something from every letter of the alphabet.
Yes.
And so we're driving, my kids were in elementary school and driving from New Jersey to Rockham Gardens, which was a needlework store, a show in Illinois back in the 80s. And we started naming stuff. And I said, okay, let's pick a category. And so we picked Americana. And my kids started naming things that had to do with American history or whatever. And that became Down Home ABCs. And it hangs in my kitchen, this design. And it's absolutely my favorite design. And that came from my kids. But my most popular design is America, Land That We Love. And this is a little motif for each of the 50 states. And in a similar fashion, we're driving to Chicago, your neck of the woods, to visit. Actually, my sister lived in the western part of Michigan at the time. But anyway, and so we started naming things that had to do with each one of the states. And so once I got to my sister's house, I hired my two kids and my two nieces, paid them 25 cents apiece for them to bring me pictures of stuff. This is before Google, keep in mind. Okay, obviously a lobster for Maine. Okay, try drawing a lobster. We all know what they look like, but try drawing one that's only going to be 24 stitches high and 27 stitches wide. And so that's how that whole design came apart, was playing a game in the car with my kids.
And your kids collect royalty on every sale, right?
No, they were paid per piece. They were paid per piece, 25 cents. So it was an interesting design.
And you stitched them?
Yes.
You actually stitched them. Okay, I'm just checking to see if you.
Oh yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's, you know, coming back to the Facebook thing, we actually have a Facebook group for people. I mean, this was something I designed in the 80s, and there are people still stitching it. And so we started a stitch-along group for people that are stitching it and support each other and encourage each other. And in fact, I have to say, I am currently stitching it. One of the sad realities of being a professional designer is sometimes you mail your needlework off to people to be photographed for kits, or that particular piece was also on the cover of Stitchery Catalog back in the 80s. And on one of these journeys, my model did not come back to me. Mm. And so I have to confess, at this point, it's been a year that I finally said, you know what, after all these years, I need to stitch this again. And so I started it with the idea that I would do one state a week. So obviously I'd get done in a year. And I think I'm up to Missouri at this point.
Yeah, I was going to say, how's that going?
Yeah. Well, I kept getting distracted. But it's okay to have more than one project going.
Yes, definitely.
It is. Yeah, I think it's required.
It's mandatory.
Actually. Yeah. 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 These stitch alongs. I was looking at a stitch along today and I've tried three or four times to do a stitch along and I'm just an utter failure at it. I can't keep up. And just about everyone, about 2 months in, it's like, oh, this is never going to happen. I'll just do it as I get to it because, you really have to be diligent to keep up with those things. And I either don't have the time or other things get in the way. Yeah, it's always something. But I admire people who can do a stitch along and, halfway through the month, I got March done. Well, I haven't even started February.
You know, everybody has their own challenges in their own life. And, you know, I think that if you know, there's not a whole lot about stitching that bothers me, but I think one of the things that does bother me is sometimes on Facebook, people will say, you know, like you just said, I can't keep up or whatever. But you know what? Everybody's life is different. Some people have 6 hours a day that they can stitch. And some people are lucky to get 6 hours a week. So you can't compare yourself to other people. Give yourself a break, Gary.
Well, yeah, I'm in that category of lucky to have 6 hours a week. I can't tell you how many Saturdays I've thought, oh, I do these three things in the morning and I have the entire day ahead of me and all I just can sit and stitch and then it'll be 10 o'clock at night and I never got to it.
It never works that way.
No, it never works that way. Ever. Yeah.
Well, I was looking forward to getting a lot of stitching time during March Madness, but that did not happen. Probably my favorite time to stitch is to be watching sports, because I can kind of watch and pay attention and know what's going on and still get my stitching done. But this year, the games were just too exciting, and I didn't get as much stitching done as I had anticipated.
Yeah, you get the right series of games, and it's hard to take your eyes off of, yep. But, yeah, we've talked more than once about what's the best sport for stitching. And baseball, you know, you can make an argument for baseball. I still think, timing-wise, football is the best.
Yeah, I think I was going to say football off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And, of course, with instant replay, you're really not missing anything.
That's why it's the best.
Right.
Yep. Although it is drag racing season.
I know.
Point that out. Drag racing has just started again.
Yep. Yeah, Christina and I are drag racing fans, and that's an excellent sport for stitching. Yes.
Yes, it is, because it's all in 6 second increments.
With long periods of time in between, yes.
That's right. Anybody can look up for 6 seconds.
Yep. Yeah, I have to admit, we both have become fans. I've really gotten myself into drag racing. It's an amazing sport. And you think you mentioned drag racing, and I've mentioned it to a couple of people. They look at me like, you know, that redneck whatever type thing.
Right.
But it's an incredibly technically precise, amazing sport. Yeah, it's a lot of downtime. A lot of downtime. Yeah. I took a 3 hour recording. It was 2 weeks ago, and I just didn't have a lot of time, so I watched just the races and fast forwarded through. I bet I did that in like 45 minutes. just the races. Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, time out. All right. So I went back. We got to get this in because I went to the trouble to do it. So we're getting it in. So, and we're running out of time. So I went back in your blog. People should go to your blog. And I went way back to your first posts. And I thought we would do a Stitcher Tips segment. So we'll see how this goes. So I took you way back in time and just picked out, what did I pick out? 6 items that I thought were interesting and just to talk about. So the first one that we have on the list here is backstitch procrastination, where you talk about people who have completed the stitching and all they have to do is the backstitching. And yeah.
Right. And this is again a topic you see on Facebook all the time. So my advice on this is to first of all to clarify. Many people have the mistaken idea that they have to have all the cross stitch done before they can start the backstitch. You know, they'll see statements like, well, first you do the cross stitch, then you do the backstitch. Well, that's true, but you don't have to have the whole project done. If it's a scene and you have the building done, then you can go ahead and do the backstitch for that building and then go on to the cross stitch. So if you find yourself not enjoying backstitch, my advice is to do it as you go along. Don't wait until the whole project's until all the cross stitch is done to start doing the backstitch. Other people love doing backstitch because it really makes the project pop and it gives it detail and depth. And, you know, they kind of save it because they enjoy it so much.
Yeah, that's one of those problematic things because for me, it's absolutely drudgery. But exactly that happens. And I go, why do I hate it so much? When it literally brings buildings to life, I mean, it brings everything to life. And so why do I put it off? Why do I hate it so much? And why don't I do it as I go along? So it's not this massive project at the end. I don't understand.
Yeah, I do it as I go.
Okay, now we expect to hear a progress report, Gary.
Okay.
I want to hear from you and find out whether or not you got over your backstitch procrastination.
Okay. All right. Well, right now I don't have anything that has to be backstitched. It's a reproduction sampler, so maybe that's why I'm doing it. I don't have to backstitch anything. Well,
but you hit upon an important thing. If you really, really hate it, bypass those projects that have it in it.
Yeah.
You know, do something else.
Yep. Yep. All right. Backstitch procrastination. Then the next one, you talk about the loop method, which is great if you are stitching with two strands or four strands. But it gets to the bigger thing, and this is the thing that if there's one thing I dislike about stitching, it's starting and ending threads, because I just find it tedious. And you know, once I discovered the pin stitch, starting them has not been nearly as irritating to me. I love the part in the middle where you're just stitching, but it just seems like starting and ending. So the loop method, that's great if you have even threads, because then you can
even number and a thread that is not variegated or over dyed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and these days you got to watch for that too, because you can't just do that. You can't just double it up and go. Yeah,
right. Ending threads. I am a let's secure this end so it doesn't ever come undone. Because if it is going to come undone, it's going to be, it's like Murphy's Law. The more you spend on framing, the higher chance that something is going to not look right when you get it back. So I definitely go under 4 or 5 stitches on the back. I also clip the end of that tail after it's buried, what I call dangerously close. I don't leave a half inch. I see students doing this all the time, and I ask them why, and they say to make sure it doesn't come undone. Well, if you think it still might come undone, then you need to bury that tail under a few more stitches.
So that's because when I read that, I was surprised, because I would never leave a tail like that. So that's the thinking, is there's that much more to pull through before it comes undone, huh?
That's what students tell me. And the thing is, those tails, they end up being shadows, or yes, you inadvertently bring it to the front when you're stitching nearby. You end up catching that and bringing it to the front. So there's no reason to leave that extra tail.
It's not adding any more friction either, so it's not really giving you any benefit.
Right. Right, absolutely.
Yeah,
when I'm teaching, I will actually, and this is something I learned from a hardanger teacher. If you can see the tips of your scissors when you're clipping something, you will never clip the wrong thing. Think about that. So I will, when I'm clipping it, and I'm sitting here kind of envisioning this, I hold on to the tail with my left hand. I've got my scissors in my right hand. And once I have it in place, parallel to the fabric and cut it, I will actually look up at the class and say, okay, I'm looking at you, I'm not looking at what I'm stitching, and I am secure in being able to clip this because I know where I put my scissors. And they're, you know, they think I'm crazy. Well, I probably am crazy.
If you can see the tips of your scissors, you will never cut the wrong thing. All right. There's one to put in the book right there.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah. Okay, now this one, which I think is important no matter what year, what day, what project, encouraging people to change colors, either in the fabric and in the colors that are prescribed for that design, encouraging people to make it your own.
Absolutely, and that is one of the biggest differences I find between people who love needlepoint and people who love cross-stitch. Cross-stitchers, and you use the right word, prescribed, they feel like that they have to do it exactly like everything is written out for them in the directions. And it's like they're frozen. They're not even willing to experiment and decide for themselves whether one strand or two strands is what they want for backstitch, or whether on a 14 count fabric, whether they want two strands or three strands. It's like, you know, loosen up a little bit, you know, play around with it and see what you like. But absolutely, if you love a sampler and it's all in pastels and you go for more bold colors, then absolutely change it.
Yeah, that's tough for some people to do. And that's an interesting dilemma when it comes to reproduction samplers. Because to me, you know, if that's one area where I want to do it just as the little girl did it and as the reproducer prescribed it, I want to match that up. But then I've seen more than one person who have said, well, this blue, I didn't care for the blue and changed it. And then they'll show and the sampler has come to life because of the color that they chose. And it seems like you're kind of getting away from the concept of reproduction. But then again, the person who changed, you know, to a different red really in many ways made it visually better. So you can't fault them.
Well, and that becomes, it's like a furniture builder who's following directions to make a shaker chest of drawers. And they make it exactly like that. And then there's somebody else who says, well, I'm going to do a shaker inspired chest of drawers. Yeah. And especially with the samplers, Gary, I mean, and research has shown this where you've had two girls in the same school that have done this quote unquote the same sampler, but they look different because they use different colors or a different count linen or whatever. So I think that you're still being true to the to that type of needlework to still to make changes, because even from that particular teacher, her students would have had different outcome.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if Christine and I were sitting in the same class and the design was put up on the board, yeah, we wouldn't do them the same. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. All right, my mind's open a little bit more here. Thank you. Now, washing and ironing finished projects. Now, that's an interesting thing. When you wrote that, pretty much DMC was the choice. Now we have so many other colors and over dyes and so on and so forth. How do you feel about washing and ironing projects today versus when you wrote that?
I still think it's important, but again, I'm pretty liberal with where I stitch and when I stitch. When I go to my granddaughter's basketball games, I bring my stitching with me. Other people have their particular place at home; they always wash their hands before they start stitching. And I'm just not that exacting. I want my needlework to be portable. So if I'm stitching something with an over-dyed linen, I will pre-wash it to find out whether or not it's going to run. If it doesn't run, I'm home safe. If it does run, there are some things that you can do to secure the color so that when you are all finished. And the same thing with all the fibers that you're stitching with. Linen and cotton are incredibly durable. And especially linen. I mean, linen's probably the sturdiest fabric out there. So there's no reason why it can't be washed. I think one of the things that people get hung up on is they may have a linen garment that very clearly says dry clean only, do not wash. And that's not because of the fabric. It's because of the construction of the garment. There's no reason why you can't wash linen. If it truly is linen, if it's 100% flax, which is what it should be if it's labeled linen. And the same thing with your fibers. And there's a different blog post about this that I wrote more recently about, washing your floss before you stitch with it so that you know whether or not it's going to run.
So, okay, so I missed that one. So you recommend that you wash all of your floss, or what did you talk about there?
I mean, if it's over dyed, if the thing is, if in doubt, I mean, if it's going to run, I'd rather know before I start stitching. Mm-hmm. And given the way I stitch, I probably would find something else to stitch with, because I want to be able to wash and iron my piece when I'm done. I find it, do you remember the hot dog commercial that was plump? It plumps while you cook it or something.
Yeah. Ballpark Franks. Yes.
Okay. Your stitches plump when you wash them, and they will look better. So I am very, it's probably one of the things I feel the most passionate about, is that your needlework should be washable, and you should do what you need to do to make it washable.
Yeah, I gathered from your writing that there was a extra passion behind that, yes.
Yeah, I am often wrong, but very rarely indecisive.
Okay. All right. So what's your ironing technique then? Between towels, or how do you go about that?
Yep. Four or five or six layers of terry towel, clean white towels. I save my old ones and pile them up on my ironing board. And this is where, again, I'm very different from a lot of people. I wash and rinse my needlework in tepid water. It does not need to be cold. Most soaps do not perform well in cold water, but tepid. And then when I take it out, I do not wring it. I just kind of swish it around the water, lay it down on a towel, roll it up just so it's not dripping wet, and then immediately lay it face down on the stack of terry towels, and then I iron it until it's dry. If I have loose stitching on the back, which is rare, I will use a pressing cloth. But if not, and I know my iron's clean, then I stitch it direct. I mean, I iron it directly on the linen. And again, because linen is a very durable fabric and it can take high heat, and I iron it until it's dry. And then I hang it up on a skirt hanger to usually overnight, just to make sure it's completely dry, air dry it basically, before I handle it to do the finishing.
So your cushion is on the front stitch side, and you're ironing directly on the back side of the piece.
Right. And interestingly, when you pull your linen back, you will actually see the impression of the stitches on the terry towel.
No. Oh. Okay. And the cushioning then prevents those stitches from getting flattened.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Now, again, if you're using metallics, you're using beads, that's a whole nother topic. But we're talking about, you know, your typical reproduction sampler or whatever. So, you know, if you're talking about cross-stitch and backstitch with, cotton floss on linen, then what I just described should be absolutely safe.
Yeah.
Other variables can make a difference.
Yeah. Okay. I loved this one where you talked about basting and tricks for minimizing counting and parking. And parking is always I've never tried it. It looks way too challenging to me. But that particular piece that you wrote about that, and the little ways that you use to minimize counting, I thought was really helpful.
Well, thank you. I think people make it too much work. When I first started doing count across stitch, people would look at me and they're like, "You have to count every stitch?" Like, no, I'm doing this row of seven. The next row, it bumps out one to the left and two to the right. I don't know how many stitches are in that row, but I just know what it is relative to the row above it. Now, once you start getting into heaven and earth designs and some of these fractals and whatnot, again, that's a whole different can of worms. So I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about your traditional cross-stitch pattern. I'm a lazy stitcher. And I'm not going to try to figure out if I'm stitching, say, with pink, and I'm stitching this area, and the next place I need to stitch with that pink is some distance away. Well, first of all, I'm not going to carry my thread that far. But I am not going to stop and try to count over to that spot. I'd rather stitch to that spot. And then that way, I'm much less inclined to make a mistake. So it's just, to me, it's all relative. you stitch a motif, and then the next thing is so many threads over or so many threads down from that particular thing. And as long as you're not making these great leaps and bounds from point A to point B, you stand a whole lot less chance of making a mistake.
And so then that leads me to conclude that you based your ground cloth for just about every project?
Only as needed.
Okay.
Absolutely. I will tell you that if when I were taught, I was taught to first grid my fabric, I would have never finished one project.
Okay. Because, see, that was the next thing I was going to say is, and I would make this argument, and I've heard others make it too, if I have to grid my entire ground cloth, by the time I actually get to the stitching, I'll have lost interest. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I kind of feel that way too. It's like, I just want to stitch the stuff.
Yeah. And again, I'm not talking about the tapestry type projects that are, you know, intense, you know, where you don't even see the ground cloth.
Yeah.
That's, if I were doing something like that, which I'm not inclined to do, but if I were to do something like that, yeah, I probably would grid. But for the types of projects that I design, which obviously are what I stitch, you can get from point A to point B for the most part without it. I was writing a follow-up blog about this, and when I'm intentionally stitching with a blog in mind, I will take photographs of them as I'm going along. So I did my little spot basting, for lack of a better term, where I'm not basting the whole thing, but I need to get from point A to point B. I want to make sure I'm in the right place. So yeah, I'm going to do a little bit of basting, and I get all done with my photograph, and I looked at it, and it was all wrong. Oh. And it was wrong because my basting was wrong.
Oh no.
So the lesson from that is, you know, basting is great, but you have to be able to depend. If you don't have those basting lines in the places where you intend for them to be, you're going to end up with more of a mess than if you didn't baste at all.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'll still end up writing about it, but that's one of the points I will make is that, you know, you can, it's not foolproof because, you know, what I was stitching relative to those grid lines was correct, but I was 10 spaces over from where I thought I was.
Ouch.
Okay. You can picture that, right?
I'd have been throwing things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the thing though that I will say that I get the hottest about are people who use water soluble and air soluble pins to do their basting. I would never, ever, ever, ever use those pens on my needlework.
Yeah. See, and Christine, you've gotten over this hump, or it was never a hump for you. But when it comes to surface embroidery and transferring a design to the cloth, that's where I just have so much trouble marking on the cloth. And I know it gets covered up and you can wash it away, but I just have so much trouble doing that. I don't like any marks. And
well, yeah, now, but
it's different.
Yeah, it's different. Let's say, for example, you take your typical reproduction sampler where a lot of the ground cloth is showing and you have done a grid. Think about all the areas where once you wash away that grid, if it comes back, you're going to see it.
Right.
That's why I say, I mean, if it's a tapestry type thing where it's an heaven and earth design and the whole area is going to be covered, I don't get quite as hot about that. But if you're talking about something where if those grid lines come back, they are going to be visible, then you've got a real problem. And I'm not a laboratory scientist, but I did enough reading and research about this to try to find out why they come back. And they can come back if the water that you use in your home is a different chemical, has different chemicals in it than the laboratory where that pen was developed, your lines can come back. If your needlework was left in your car on a summer day, those lines can come back because you've added different chemicals and you've added the heat process. And anybody knows anything about chemistry, you change any one thing and your results are going to be different.
I just got to get past this.
Yeah.
I think it's totally different. And it's interesting too, as I'm stitching this piece, that's exactly the way that you describe, with big open areas and just little motifs. And so I started this piece as very much a beginner and not knowing anything. So not knowing any of the rules that I was supposed to follow. So I didn't know I was supposed to baste or mark or any of the things that I was supposed to do. So I just started from a place, and I've been doing it pretty much exactly the way you describe, where I'm stitching relative to something else. So I'm not, I count when I have to, but I very much do what you've been describing, where you stitch a row and then the next row is relative to the row that you just stitched. And there will be places where I've found that, you know, I've stitched something and it's been a little bit off. And if it's off by one or two, I'm looking at it, and again, because it's a beginner piece, if it's something that is noticeable and is detrimental to the piece, then I'll stop and tear it out. If it isn't, then I leave it as it is, because it doesn't, none of the rest of the piece depends on that motif, right? It's not a geometric piece where if something is off by a stitch, if it's transposed by a stitch one way or the other, it's going to matter. It affects the piece not at all. Now, that said, would I do it differently if I was going to do it again? Would I try to do it, you know, a little bit more carefully? Probably, you know, and as I've stitched it, I think I've learned little tricks about how to, you know, how to mark things, how to know where I am a little bit better. But yeah, when you're stitching motifs, it's really all about where it is relative to another thing. So, and the size of this piece, if I had to baste it, I would have gone crazy. So I would not have done that. When I did start it, I did start with a pen, and I think I made three dots and said, this is a terrible idea, and washed them all out, because I started doing that and realized that I would have to mark up the entire canvas in places that would be visible. And there was something about it that just felt really wrong. And I just washed it all out. Then that said, on other fabrics, I've marked, you know, for surface embroidery with pencil or with pen or with powders or all those kinds of things. But that I'm always marking well inside what I'm going to stitch, and it's always sort of a guide. And, mm-hmm. and what I've learned to do with that is I have had to learn that my lines are intended to be a guide and not a prescription, as Gary would say. I think. I think that, you know, when you're doing a cross stitch, you're following everything to the letter. And with surface embroidery, when I started doing it, I would follow every line exactly. And then I'd, you know, sort of step back from the piece and look at it and say, that's not a graceful piece, because I was following a line that I traced. Whereas if I just use that as sort of like an idea of what I wanted and then stitched a line that flowed or that made sense at the time, it would have come out much better. So those lines really are just more for placement. And then the stitching just becomes a lot more fluid, I guess, if that makes any sense. So I'm just kind of laying out, you know, sort of what it is that I'm going to do in general ideas, and then looking at reference material and stitching by that.
You're really becoming a needle artist.
Wow. Look at a piece before you say artist. I'll say that. But I think it's just a little bit.
You are one with your stitching.
It's you know what it is? I think that when you divorce yourself from the line and you realize that your line isn't straight and you can stitch it straighter, you make a nicer piece, right? Mm-hmm. When you're stitching a stem of a flower and you can look at it and say, well, the stem would flow this way, would bend this way, and your line is not that, you know, drawn that way, then you should stitch it the way it should go. Right. So I kind of, as the more of it I do, the less I draw, because I don't want to be stuck into something because I've drawn it, now I have to cover it. So there's that, you know, and then there's detail work that you, you know, you have to be careful of and things like that. So yeah, the drawing part, the one thing that I do know is that, especially when I'm working on silks, I don't want to wash it. You know, once that mark is on there, I don't want to have to mess around with it, because trying to wash anything out is never works well. So the less I can mark it, the better.
So, sounds good.
Yeah. That's kind of where I go with that.
It's exciting. It's exciting to learn a new needlework technique.
It is. It is. And, you know, sometimes I'll stitch it and it'll work. And sometimes I'll stitch it and say, wow, that doesn't look right at all. And then you can always take it out and stitch it again. You know, there's always do-overs.
All right. We're going to run out. Actually, we did run out of time, but we're going to keep going. I want this last one in here because the question was to rip or not to rip things out. But the statement that made me even want to bring this up was Gene, when you said that ripping out things is a necessary part of the creative process. Had not thought of it that way.
Good, huh? Well, and I think that, if I remember correctly, that probably speaks more again to needlepoint than it does to cross stitch. If you're following a cross stitch pattern to the T, you probably aren't going to do very much ripping out for reasons of the creative process. It might be because there's a mistake. Now, if you're changing colors, then you are being creative. And again, you have to be willing to say, okay, I changed those reds to blues, and now those greens don't look right. So am I going to change the blues, or am I going to change the greens? And so, yeah, you have to be willing to back up a few steps if you're going to be a part of the actual creative process and not just follow a set of directions. So, you know, in needlepoint, unless you're following a stitch guide, again, to the T, and I find very, very rarely do people do that, then, you know, when you get an inspiration, you say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to, you know, fill this area with the mosaic stitch, and you find that the scale is wrong. It's just too tiny. It doesn't have enough of an oomph. So you say, okay, I need to rip that out and change it to the Scotch stitch, or vice versa. And so, yeah, I think that you have to be willing to say, that doesn't work, so let me try something else.
Gene, this has been fun. We got to end. Darn it. That means you have to come back, though. See, I have more questions, so you have
to
come
good.
Back. Yes.
Yes, please.
Would love to do it. It was fun.
Thanks so much for doing this. Really been a treat, and we got to end. Thanks to everybody for listening, and Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.